a joy to be here this morning. I just love it. But anyway, I love you guys and excited to see you. So excited about what God's going to do today and tomorrow and through the weekend. You know, one of the things I say, and I don't want it too long, but I want to make a couple of comments and have Jay come up. But one of the things I've always said, when I first gave my life to the Lord, God so revealed himself to me that I never needed any proof from that point on. I didn't need anything. And I know that the world would point at that and say, well, you need proof. You need that. I knew him so real and so powerfully. And whatever he said, I just believed it because I saw his glory and his power. And I still believe it today. But as I begin to grow in the Lord and begin to see all the evidence that God has given us, the power to stand on the truth of God's word and to see it backed up by God's word, especially when it comes to things like creation and this kind of stuff, it truly excited me. And I've always loved this ministry. You might be thinking, why in the world for a men's conference will we have a theme of creation? The reason being is, guys, look, we can always study 1 Peter and the book of Jonah and all these, and that's fantastic. But really what I wanted this year in our hearts for men, if we don't have a strong foundation, it doesn't matter how well the rest of the house is built, it's going to collapse at some point. And if you don't believe the word of God from the very beginning, the first 11 chapters, literally as God said it, and see the evidence, so if you're doubting even today because of pressures from the world, and if you don't believe it completely, you're going to be weak in other areas the rest of your life. You need a strong foundation. I need a strong foundation. And what this kind of ministry does is it gives a strong foundation. That carries into our wife, that carries into our kids, that carries into this fellowship, that carries into the community, and that carries into the world. And I believe there's going to be a great reward for those when we stand before Jesus Christ who simply believe the word of our God, whether we understood it all or not. And that is what this is about. That is what this is about. So I'm excited about this ministry. I saw Jay speak at the Pastors and Leaders Conference a year ago in Stone Mountain, and I said, I want that guy here, so I don't want to take up his time. So let's welcome Jay Seeger with Starting Point Ministry. Come on up, Jay.
Well, good morning. It is an unbelievable honor to be here. I can't wait for this weekend. Lots of information. But I also want to make a note right up front. Everything that I share is really focused on the authority of God's word. Sometimes I say, you can believe so much of what is in here. And then people laugh a little bit. I say, no, you can believe everything that is in here, cover to cover. So we're going to be talking about that, firing you up in your faith. I love men's conferences because men, in a sense, just they eat this stuff up. I've done some women's conferences and I found out they eat it up too because they're mama bears and they want to protect their children. And anyway, so it's interesting to everyone. Again, I'm thankful to be here. I've got two talks before lunch, one talk after lunch, and then the four services this weekend. And I know many of you don't know me from a hole in the ground, so I want to go over my background very quickly here. This is me, and that's a hole in the ground. So there are a few differences. I just use this slide all the time. It warns you about my very, very dry sense of humor. But I was raised in a Christian home, and you can see very clearly that that is a Christian home. And in fact, it was my mom that led me to Christ in a backyard Bible club when I was 5 years old. Very, very indebted to my parents for myself being here today. Ultimately, it's God, but God used my parents in a great, powerful way. They not only told me the truth, they lived it out in their lives, and that made a huge, huge difference. They just didn't have a bunch of rules and regulations. There was a relationship there, and I saw it true in their life, and it became true in my life as well. So very thankful to them. I'm from Wisconsin. My wife, Amy, is traveling with me. She's out in the lobby. You'll probably meet her later. But I was raised in a Christian home, but I went to public schools all the way through high school. When I graduated from high school, I went to a Christian university, John Brown University in Arkansas, to study mechanical engineering. I got a degree there, but then I became more interested in physics. They didn't have a physics major there, so I left Arkansas. I went back to Wisconsin and went to the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater to get a degree in physics. And that's when my world changed quite a bit. Going from a small Christian university where my engineering professors opened up every class in prayer, which is cool, to a large state university where my physics professors did not open up in prayer. And maybe they forgot. I should have reminded them. But they were telling me that everything I believed was wrong. And that made me very uncomfortable to be surrounded by those PhD scientists who I assumed had a lot of evidence for what they believed, but I realized for the first time in my entire life that even though I knew what I believed, I did not know why. So the question was, how did I really, really know that God exists? Not just believe God exists, but how did I know that God exists? How did I know the creation account was scientifically valid? That's huge, studying physics. How did I know there was a worldwide flood? How did I know that Jesus was the Son of God? How did I know that the Bible was the inspired Word of God? I was raised to believe every one of those things, and I did believe them. I just couldn't defend it. So God put it in my heart to start looking into things. So I've been looking into things now for 39 years, and almost 18 years ago, felt led into full-time ministry, founded the Starting Point Project. It's all about our starting point. In fact, my second talk today will be all about starting points. I won't take time to explain where we came up with the name. It'll make sense after the second talk here. So I've been traveling for full-time for the last about 18 years. Along the way, I was invited to be on the board of directors of a group called Logos Research Associates. This is the world's largest group of scientists who are Christians and creationists. The founding member, Dr. John Sanford from Cornell University, he's famous for having invented something called the gene gun. Inserts genes into the DNA. He was an atheist for much of his life and part of his career, but came to the conclusion there must be a God. Actually became a creationist first and then a Christian. The science was overwhelming. He's like, evolution is not possible. Became a creationist and then a Christian. Very strong Christian man now, very godly, very humble. He's a great, great guy. Another board member, Dr. John Baumgartner. He's a PhD geophysicist. He just happened to build the world's best 3D computer simulation of plate tectonics. Again, just off the charts brilliant. Even secular geologists will use this model to see how plates of the earth are moving. So there's those two scientists, and then myself and a bunch of other board members. And I always say, as brilliant as these guys are, and they are really, really smart, if they were here with us this morning, they would be the first to admit, out of all eight board members, I am the tallest. So I'm pretty proud of that. Hate to brag, but 2 years ago, Dr. Sanford, who started the group, asked if I would step up and become president. So now I guess I'm president, and I've lost respect for all the other guys if they want me to lead them. So it's just, I literally walk around my house in Wisconsin just laughing at all the things that God is doing, knowing it has nothing to do with me at all. God wants to do something. He's allowing me to go along for the ride. If I don't get in his way, it'll probably continue. So I'm working really hard not to mess things up. But it's just cool being associated with some of the world's leading scientists because they're doing cutting-edge research, and then I get to take it and translate it into something we call English so that everyone else can understand. So brilliant researchers, thankful to be a part of that group. Quick summary, over 17 years of full-time ministry, given over 3,300 lectures. Been all over the United States, 9 other countries, spoken at the U.S. Naval Academy. I think it's been 5 times now. They want it to be an annual event. Spoken to West Point officers many times. They want it to be an annual event. I'll be out there, I think, in next month talking to some more officers. Lead Grand Canyon tours, which I'll talk about a little bit more later. Here's a picture from the top of the famous Horseshoe Bend at sunset. It's just beautiful. We hired our daughter about 3 years ago, so she works with me full-time. She goes on all the tours. And this is from 2 weeks ago. My wife, Amy, was with me and got to go to some place. She's been on the tour a long time ago, but we've added some things. So she also got to see the beautiful Antelope Canyon that we hiked through, too. It's just gorgeous. I'll have an entire talk on the flood after lunch. And then a little over a year ago, I was approached by someone. They said, you need to have your own podcast. I said, well, that'd probably be cool, but I have absolutely no time to do podcasts. So now I'm doing podcasts. And we've got about 86, 87 of them, I think, every Friday. So just yesterday, a new one came out. And we've already reached the top 5% of podcasts on the planet, which, again, it's a God thing, not me. I'm just at home in my basement office just saying stuff into a mic, and now it's in over 50-plus countries, which is really cool. So those are free on Apple and Spotify. I'll talk about our resources some other time. But just I also have written 3 books. The one on creation, which we've got all 3 books here. This is the only thing we sell are our books. Everything else is free. The book on creation, I've been told by some of the world's leading scientists, I think it's the best overview that's out there, which I was honored to hear. It's the first shot at writing a book. But this is what you paid the big bucks for, presentation. So the first talk, I'm entitling it Evolution Probable or Problematic. And here's the background. A number of years ago, there was a bioinformatics symposium at Cornell University, sponsored by Dr. John Sanford, the gene gun guy who started Logos Research Associates. I had met him briefly, didn't know him well at all, but this was a scientific symposium, 27 lectures in 3 days. It was by invitation only. You couldn't just show up, you had to be invited. Well, Dr. Sanford contacted me and asked if I'd like to go. I said, oh, I'd love to. So I went out there, 27 lectures in 3 days by some of the world's leading scientists. It was intense. I took a lot of notes, put this presentation together, called Dr. Sanford, who I still didn't know at the time, said, if I come back out to New York, could I spend a little time with you picking your brain, showing you my presentation, make sure it's accurate? He said, sure. I stayed at his house for 2.5 days. I was like a kid in a candy store. And I asked him a lot of questions, showed him the presentation. He said, yes, it's accurate, and I love your PowerPoint. So I said, thank you. So you're going to hear a talk that's centered around this bioinformatics symposium. Bioinformatics, it's just information in living things. And the symposium was not a creation conference. It was at Cornell University. They wanted it to be scientific, talking all about DNA and mutations and things like that, not Genesis and Jesus and Adam and Eve and all that. Very powerful, but all evidence showing that we are not an accident. We did not evolve. So how many of you have ever seen Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? A few of you have, but dangerous show to watch. You might find out that maybe you're not smarter than a fifth grader. We're going to switch this up and ask, are you smarter than a PhD scientist? Now, most people will say, well, of course not. I mean, these guys are brilliant. And they are. They are truly brilliant. Even the atheistic scientists, brilliant men and women. I honestly believe after you hear this presentation, you will be smarter than most PhD scientists when it comes to the creation versus evolution controversy. And why is that? Is it that these scientists aren't very smart? Oh, no, they're brilliant. It's because most of them know nothing about this, because most of them are not studying this. They're making rocket fuel, food preservatives, you know, just all cool things, gadgets, computers. This is not their area. They know nothing about it. Even the scientists who do study the life sciences, some of them aren't familiar with this, and those who are don't like to think about it. And we're ultimately dealing with a spiritual issue. But once you learn this, you'll be better positioned to discuss this controversy because it's so powerful. Now, since we're talking about evolution, we need to define this because this word is used in so many different ways. For example, they'll talk about the evolution of the phone. You guys are old enough to know that the phone has changed a bit over time. And they'll call that evolution. I actually don't have a problem with that. They want to call that evolution, that's fine. But that's not what I'm referring to this morning, and it's not what they're talking about in the school system when they're teaching evolution. I'm also not referring to different breeds of dogs, about 350 breeds today. I'm also not talking about a variety of cats. I'm also not talking about different beaks on finches that Darwin got very excited about. These are facts of science. Nobody denies those things, but those things have nothing to do with evolution, as I'm referencing this morning, or as they're teaching it in grade school, junior high, high school, and universities. This is what I'm referring to, and this is what they're teaching. 3.8 billion years ago, there was a single-celled organism that came from dead chemicals. It's a whole other story. And then that single cell turned itself into every other life form on this planet over a few billion years. This is what they're teaching. This is what I'm referring to this morning. And I call this a story, not to be sarcastic or disrespectful or condescending, to be literal. It is a story. They weren't there. They didn't see it. They're trying to figure out what might have happened millions of years ago when they didn't observe it. It truly is a story. I also refer to this as molecules to man evolution. And I recommend you use that phrase. If you just say you don't believe in evolution, the skeptic's going to think you're crazy because they're going to say, we see change all the time. Well, what just happened there? Something technically, it's called equivocation, where you set two things equal that are not equal, evolution and change. Now, evolution would involve change, but it's not just any kind of change. You would need a kind of change that makes things better and more complex over time. We don't see those kinds of changes. We see change all the time, but not those types of changes. But if you say you don't believe in evolution, they're going to think you deny change, which would be crazy. So you could say, I don't believe in molecules to man evolution. Dead molecules came together to be alive, and then that cell turned itself into every other life form on this planet. We don't see those types of changes. And here's the general premise of this presentation. Certain things look pretty good from a certain distance, certain angle, like this bright red BMW. You envision opening the hood and seeing a beautiful engine in there. What if you open the hood and you saw this? The engine's missing. A bunch of wires are hanging there. So what looked pretty good upon first inspection, on second inspection, you look a little closer, pop the hood, and it doesn't look so good anymore. That's what we're going to see about evolution. Some of it seems to make sense. Well, it's plausible. I could see that happening. But then you pop the hood, and you're like, okay, that ain't going to happen. And it is not hard to imagine evolution happening. So the plausibility of evolution as they're teaching it in the school systems and universities. There are two creatures up here, a snake and a reptile, a little lizard. These two creatures do not look completely different. There are similarities there. It doesn't take much imagination to envision bumps starting to form on the side of the snake. They become bigger and bigger, and they eventually turn into some legs, and it crawls around. Now it's a lizard. Just little changes here and there over millions of years. Yeah, it's possible, right? The students think that. They write it down. It's going to be on the test. But when you peek under the hood to see what has to go on inside, specifically in the DNA, that's when you realize, oh, that can't happen. And that's what we're going to be exploring in this presentation. I have a quote from Richard Dawkins, arguably the world's leading atheist today. I actually like Richard Dawkins because I think he's pretty straightforward. He's very honest about what he believes as an atheist, and I appreciate that. I don't think he'd like me, which is fine, but I've learned a lot from him, and I think he's a pretty good representative of atheism, and this is one of his quotes. You cannot be both sane and well-educated and disbelieve in evolution. The evidence is so strong that any sane, educated person has got to believe in evolution. Very intimidating statement by a very intelligent scientist. And imagine our kids and grandchildren going through the school system, hearing this from professors, teachers. You know, how do you respond? If they say they don't believe in evolution, they're admitting to everyone around them, yeah, I'm kind of crazy. I don't really buy into all the science stuff. I just believe my Bible. Nobody wants to respond that way. So, and again, right now, probably 70, 75% of Christian youth are walking away from their faith before they finish college. That's a whole other presentation I don't have time to get to. Proverbs 18 says, the first one to please his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. And we've all been in that position before where at first when you hear something, you're like, how can you possibly argue with that? That sounds pretty solid. But someone else says, wait a minute, did you know about this or that or that? Oh, no, I didn't know about that. Okay, this first thing, that doesn't sound so good anymore. I facetiously say that evolution 1-1 says the only one to plead his cause seems right because no one else is allowed to challenge him or present other views. This is what we have in our educational system today in this country. They're only presenting one view. So, of course, it's going to seem plausible because there's nothing else going on. And if someone raises their hand, well, what about creation? Well, thank you for bringing that up now. See, now that's a religious view, but we're here in school in biology. We're here to talk about science and truth and reality. Creation is a religious myth, and if you want to learn about that somewhere else, that's fine, but not in the science classroom. And if scientists ever figure out that there's a different way, they'll let us know, but they've studied for years and they've proven it's evolution. That's what we're going to teach here. That's intimidating. They're only presenting one view. Here's an interesting quote from Dr. Eugenie Scott. She's actually the former executive director of the National Center for Science Education, an organization that was drafted to combat biblical creation. This is what she said. In my opinion, using creation and evolution as topics for critical thinking exercises in primary and secondary schools is virtually guaranteed to confuse the students about evolution and may lead them to reject it. What is she saying? We can't present two views because some of the kids might reject evolution. We can't have that. So we're only going to present one view and tell them that's the only thing out there. It's been proven. We know that. There's no reason to consider anything else. So that's what they do. And they have the microphone, they own the educational system and the media and the entertainment and all that. So it becomes very challenging for us to make any headway. But we still have God on our side, which is better than anything. No, I don't have time to go through the entire big picture. I have other presentations where we talk about big picture things like the origin of stuff, matter and energy. If there is no God, where did stuff come from? I have a lot to say about that, but that'd be a different presentation. I have podcasts on that and video series and all that. Where'd stuff come from if there is no God? And once you have stuff, how does it organize itself into galaxies, stars, and planets? That's a whole other talk. The laws of physics mitigate against that. Once you have planets, how do you get dead chemicals on one of those planets to come together to form a living cell? That is a huge, huge problem. And don't let them fool you. Oh, we're getting so close. No, you're getting further away. The more you study the cell, the more complex it's becoming. And then once you have a living cell, how do you turn that living cell into every other life form on this planet? That's what we're going to focus on. How do you get a single-celled organism to turn it all the way into a human being? Interesting question. We'll explore that. Now, there's a lot of arranging and storytelling that goes on when discussing evolution. I've got four modes of transportation up here. We could arrange these things from what appears to be simpler to more complex, and we could talk about the evolution of the motorcycle. You see, the smaller wheels at the back of the tricycle got together and made a larger back wheel of the bicycle. And then the chains of the bicycle slowly turned into an electric motor of the scooter. And then the electric motor of the scooter, small changes over time, turned into a gas combustion engine. That's how we got motorcycles. That is a very silly story. But all I did is I took real things, lined them up visually, and told you how small changes happened over time. That's what happens when we teach evolution. Very, very often. Here's a real-life example, the evolution of the horse. From Eohippus all the way to the modern horse. I'm going to give you a quote from Dr. Niles Eldridge. He's one of the world's leading evolutionists. And here's his background. He's the former curator at the American Museum of Natural History. Keep that in mind as you hear his quote. I admit that an awful lot has gotten into the textbook as though it were true. For instance, the most famous example still on exhibit in the American Museum, that's his museum, is the exhibit on horse evolution. That has been presented as literal truth in textbook after textbook. Now, I think that that is lamentable, but by the time it filters down to the textbooks, we got a problem. What's he saying? Okay, it didn't really happen, and it probably shouldn't be in the textbooks. Then why is it in your museum? Just think about the millions of youth and adults go through the museum. They see things lined up and the plaques underneath describing the changes that have occurred over millions of years. You can't argue with that. That's science. That's proof. No, that's a display in a museum with stuff written beneath it. And he said it didn't even happen. Then why is it in the museum? Well, you know, it costs money to change the displays and all that. So let's leave the false stuff in there until we have some new false stuff to put in there in its place. If they took it out, excuse me, they wouldn't have anything to put in its place. So that's a problem, but we do that. We line things up, tell stories, and the students think, oh, it's proven science. No, it's not. Here's a book of life from Stephen Jay Gould. He was one of the world's leading evolutionists, and he had a graphic in there depicting the evolution of fish to amphibians over millions of years. Well, what did it look like in the middle? I was giving this presentation at a state university, and right when I got to this slide, a skeptic stood up. He goes, they found that missing link. It's Tiktaalik. I said, thank you for mentioning that. And I clicked, and Tiktaalik shows up. I said, yeah, they found another fossil. They had never seen this one before, and they had a current lineup. Where would this one fit? Well, visually, it looks like, if anywhere, it's going to be here. So they put it there in the textbooks, and they tell us that this is a transitional form. There's already scientific reasons why this doesn't count. I don't have time to go into all the details. It has to do with finding footprints and all that. No, Tiktaalik really isn't a missing link, but it worked as a visual picture for a while, and it's still in many textbooks, even though it's been disqualified. But doing something like this isn't much different than doing something like this. Talking about how an Etch-a-Sketch evolved into an iPad. These two objects are not completely different. There are some similarities. What did it look like in the middle? Use your imagination. Maybe kind of a little bit of one, a little bit of the other. But you know, excuse me, just have a tickle in my throat from getting over cold, but feel good. But you know there's no way the simple internal workings of an Etch-A-Sketcher ever going to turn themselves into something as complex as an iPad. Not going to happen. But again, just draw some pictures, use your imagination, tell the stories, and it's going to be on the test. So how do you make the transition from a single-celled organism 3.8 billion years ago to a human being? Well, when we reproduce, our kids don't look exactly like us. Changes do happen. They might have similar hair color and eye color, but they're not going to be identical, you know, copies of us. So changes happen. We see changes happen. Excuse me. And there are two types of changes. We have built-in variation and we have random mutations. The built-in variation is related to the information in our DNA, the genes. And we've got a pretty good bead on that to know what to expect from the information that's in the DNA. Random mutations, as far as evolution is concerned, they're random copying errors. That's what a mutation is. Something reproduces itself, it copies its DNA, but it makes a mistake. There's so much information there, it makes copying errors. We've actually discovered that some of these changes in the DNA are pre-programmed, purposeful changes. It's very complex. I'm going to leave those out and just talk about the only ones that evolutionists can deal with, accidental changes. They can't talk about purpose and design. So the changes are just oops, 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 mutations. Those are the two types of changes. And those are, we don't know what to expect with that because they're random. So let's look at these two. Built-in variation first. We have two dogs here with medium-length fur. And each dog has two copies of genes that make fur length. Why do they have two copies? Because they got one from mom and one from dad. These two dogs have a gene that makes long fur and short fur, L and S. In their bodies, the genes combined and gave them medium-length fur. When they reproduce, if you breed them together, they're each going to pass on one of those genes. They don't pick or choose, just one goes or the other. If you breed them and they each pass on a gene for short fur, the puppy's going to come out with short fur. It doesn't matter which gene is used or if they combine. It's going to have short fur. If they both pass on a gene for long fur, the puppy's going to come out with long fur. If one passes on a gene for short, the other for long, the puppy can come out with short fur, it can have long fur, or it can have medium-length fur if the genes combine. So genes are responsible for making fur length. They don't just make fur length. They can do other things, too. They give us big dogs, small dogs, long ears, short ears. All the features we see on dogs are pre-coded in the genes. Now, if you look at these two sets of animals, set A and B, which set of animals looks more similar to each other? Pretty obvious, the animals in set A look a lot more like each other than the animals in set B. And why is that? Because the animals in set A are really the same kind of animal. Genesis chapter 1, 10 times says God created creatures to reproduce after their kind. Can they produce a variety? Oh, great variety, but always within limits. Today you can breed dogs, dingoes, coyotes, and wolves. They can all breed together. In fact, you breed a dog and a wolf, you get a wolf dog. Looks a little bit like the dog, a little bit like the wolf. This is expected in biology. This is expected scripturally. You can breed these things because of the same kind of animal. Even though they consider them different species, they're the same kind that the Bible uses the word kind. But you can't breed a dog and a wolf and get an ostrich because they don't have genetic information to make beaks and feathers. So you can get a variety, but always within limits. You can also breed a zebra and a donkey, and you get a zonkey. It sounds kind of funny, but it's real science. Why? Are these two creatures totally different? No, they're very similar. One just has a nice paint job. You can also breed a lion and a tiger, and you get a liger. Why? Because they're both large cats. They're the same kind of animal. But you can't breed a lion and a kangaroo to get a lion-garoo. That one's not going to happen. They're not the same kind of animals. There are a bunch of other animals you're also not going to get. It would be these here. This is what happens when you have Photoshop and too much time in your hands, of which I have neither. But the reason that we laugh right away is we know that can't happen. The scientists say, yeah, that can't happen, but it's kind of creative. They're not the same kind of animal. They're not going to combine. That was a little bit about the built-in variation. Now we're going to take a look at the random mutations, these copying errors. And we are now magically transformed from a men's conference at a church to a state university biology classroom, and I'm going to be the PhD biology professor, and I'm going to teach you how evolution works. So we have an organism. It's going to reproduce. It needs to copy its DNA. So it does that. It has children. And you can see these children look very much like the parents because it's a copy of the same DNA. The children reproduce and have grandchildren that look very much like the parents and the grandparents. It's copied the same DNA. Then the grandchildren reproduce, and, oh, we have some significant mutations happening here. Some apparently are good, and some are bad. And then natural selection comes along like a superhero and wipes out the bad changes and just keeps those good ones. And then reproduction continues. The new good ones reproduce and make more of those, and then the original ones reproduce, and you have more of those too. And this process continues on for millions and millions of years. Can you imagine the great variety that we would have through a process like this? Now, I guarantee you, the non-Christian students sitting in that classroom hearing this, they see this and they say, that makes perfect sense to me. You cannot argue with that. That's science. This is my PhD professor. He knows what he's talking about. But I guarantee you, the Christian students hearing this come to pretty much the same conclusion. You can't argue with this. I mean, this is science. I mean, the Bible was written a long time ago. They didn't really know all the technical details that we know today. And, you know, you can interpret it different ways. And God's all-powerful. Maybe he used evolution, whatever. This is truth. This is black and white. You can't argue with it. But the Bible, you can kind of play fast and furious with it, kind of get it to say whatever you want it to say. So that's what they conclude. Well, we're going to take a closer look at these mutations. And I'm noticing many of you are old enough to remember Paul Harvey, who was famous for telling us the rest of the story. We're going to look at the rest of the story, in which you're going to see it sounded pretty good there. Doesn't make any sense at all when we pop the hood and see what's going on inside. So a closer look at these mutations. I'm going to make three major points with mutations. Number one, they are random, purposeless, and undirected. Secondly, they occur in the DNA. And thirdly, they're almost entirely detrimental or bad. I've actually never drank water while speaking before. I never needed it, but with the tickle, it'll probably help. So we're going to go through each one of these fairly quickly. The first, that these changes, these mutations, are random and purposeless. Here's a quote from Nova Online. This is a secular source talking about these mutations. It's sometimes convenient when trying to make sense of evolution to think of changes within a species of having a purpose, as though Mother Nature has some intended goal that she sets out to achieve. The bacteria want to survive, someone might reason when thinking about the declining effects of antibiotics, and so they evolve into resistant strains. Of course, there is no purpose in evolution, just random mutations within DNA, most of which are detrimental to the survivability of the organism. Those are the three points that I just made on the previous screen. I actually created the PowerPoint slide first, and then I found this quote. I was like, that's cool. They're backing up the very points that I'm making. They're random. They're happening in the DNA. They're basically bad. That's what they're admitting. Here's another secular source talking about dinosaurs. Presumably, the sauropods evolved large body size as a strategy to deter predators. Okay, what's going on here? This is what they're insinuating. Apparently, at some point in the past, dinosaurs weren't as large as they eventually came to be. So they're sitting around the campfire one night, and they're saying, hey, you guys, we need to come up with a strategy to deter our predators. Otherwise, we're going to go extinct much quicker than we're supposed to. Do you have any ideas? And they say, no, our brains are too small. And then one of them says, I got an idea. What if we get some machine guns? We could shoot our predators. And the lead dinosaur says, no, we can't do that. They haven't been invented yet. Okay, good point. Second dinosaur says, I got an idea. What if we hopped onto our Harleys and rode off into the sunset? Pastor Mark likes that. they said, no, we can't do that. They haven't been invented either. Okay, good point. Third dinosaur says, I got an idea. What if we evolve really large body sizes and we could scare them away? And the lead dinosaur says, now that's a good idea. Are we all in agreement? Yep, okay, break. And they go out and they get big. There's not a scientist on the planet who believes that. Even the evolutionists, they don't think that some creature needed something, so it decided to evolve it. No, creatures are just living their lives. They reproduce, and they copy themselves, basically, the same DNA. They're not trying to accomplish something to, so that their great, whatever grandchildren could survive better or appreciate something. No, they're just reproducing. But the popular literature gives you the impression a creature needed something to survive, so it evolved it. If it takes millions of years, how does it survive while it's waiting? See, the fish were swimming around in the oceans. Food became scarce. So they needed to evolve lungs to go up on the land to find new sources of food. So they evolved lungs. Guess what the students do? They write it down. Well, the fish had to do something. They would have died if they didn't. So they had, of course they evolved lungs. How did fish know what lungs are? I know they swim around in schools, but how would they know what a lung is? Even if they knew what a lung was, what are they going to do about it? They only have genetic information to make fish parts. And even if they reproduce and make some mistakes in their DNA, what do they do when they can't breathe underwater anymore, but they don't have lungs yet? They can't survive. It makes no sense. But the students write it down because they're not given time to think and they've lost critical thinking skills and it's going to be on the test. You need to pass the test to pass the class. You need to pass the class to get out of school, to get on with your life and enjoy. So you just write it down. You don't care. Whatever. So you write it down, even though it doesn't make any sense. So that was just a really brief overview of these mutations are random. Now they occur in the DNA. This will be really, really quick. Most of you know a lot of this already. DNA is like a very, 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 very complex blueprint with lots and lots and lots of information on it. Let's talk about storage capacity of DNA. Let's say you had just a teaspoon amount of your own DNA, just a teaspoon, and you want to back that up onto a thumb drive, and we back up our computers in case they crash. So you had a teaspoon of your DNA, and the amount of information that could fit there, you want to back it up on a thumb on a 64 gig thumb drive. That's a pretty good, pretty hefty size thumb drive. In fact, you could fit almost 10 million pages of text on a 64 gig thumb drive. That's a lot of information. So how much of that thumb drive would get filled up from just a teaspoon amount of your DNA? Well, it would fill up the entire thumb drive. You'd need more than one thumb drive. So how many thumb drives would you need? How about 1,000? That would be impressive. It's not right, but that would be impressive. How about 1,000,000? That would really be impressive. Like, no way. 1,000,000 thumb drives? That's still not right. Someone would have to give you 1,000,000 thumb drives every day for 139 years, and then you'd have enough space to back up just a teaspoon amount of your own DNA. That is amazing. Oh, that just happened by accident. Particles banging together over time did all that. Yeah, you know, my faith isn't strong enough to believe that. That makes no sense whatsoever. So again, DNA. DNA is like a set of encyclopedias. Most of you remember what encyclopedias are, right? Well, each rung on that ladder of DNA, we call it a nucleotide, it's kind of equivalent to a single letter out of that set of encyclopedias. And when you put a bunch of rungs together, you could build words. And if you put thousands or tens of thousands together, you can build a chapter from the set of encyclopedias, and that's what we call a gene. So thousands or tens of thousands of those rungs, that's equivalent to like a gene in your DNA. When you put thousands of the genes together, you build a chromosome. You've all heard of chromosomes. That's like a single volume out of the set of encyclopedias. And then the entire set of encyclopedias, that's what we call the genome. For people, we call it the human genome. That's just a phrase that represents all the information on your DNA. It's a little biology 101. The third part, this is where it gets much, much more interesting, that these mutations are almost entirely detrimental. So here's the story of evolution. Again, I call it story not to be condescending. Literally, this is the story that they're telling us about evolution. So let's say you had a biochemistry textbook. The amount of information in a biochemistry textbook is about the amount of information we find in a single-celled organism. There are no simple cells. Many cells are simpler than we are, but they're not simple. But that's the equivalent. Single cell has about the amount of information you find in a biochemistry textbook. So how do you get that single cell to turn all the way into a human being? Well, obviously, you got to make some changes along the way, right? So here's a book called Biological Information, New Perspectives. This was the book that was generated from the Bioinformatics Symposium at Cornell University. They put all the papers together, and they have this book. We're going to look at a page here. You don't have to worry about reading all this. I have a section highlighted. We're going to put it off to the left there. If we took the information in this textbook and copied it perfectly over and over and over, millions of years from now, we would just have a lot more of these textbooks because they're copying it perfectly. If you want to turn that textbook, which is our single cell, into something like a human being, you got to make a lot of changes. Well, what are those changes? Mutations, accidental copying errors. It's the only game in town, they will admit. Got a quote from UC Berkeley saying mutations are the only game in town. They're the only source of raw genetic information for evolution to occur. Copying errors. So we're going to look at these copying errors. First, we have a duplication mutation. That's where you duplicate something so that we have the word level, and we duplicate the L. It doesn't spell level anymore. Now, if you were reading that, you'd say, oh, it's just a copying error, just typo. It's level, and you'd move on. That's not how our genetics work. Our genetics would see that. I've never seen this before. It doesn't mean anything. You would have destroyed that piece of information. Then we have a deletion mutation. We take the M out of model. It doesn't spell model. Then we have a substitution mutation. We take the P out of probability and put a Z in there instead. It doesn't spell probability. These are examples of what we call point mutations, random changes. So it gets really, really interesting. If you were to ask a six-year-old, what is your favorite book? And then they told you the name of a book. And said, okay, if we took your book, closed our eyes, opened up to a random page, stuck our finger in there, whatever letter we touch, we put an extra one of those letters in. And we close our eyes again, go to a different page, touch something, whatever we touch, we erase it. Then we do it again, whatever we touch, we take whatever we're touching out, we put something else in, maybe even a number instead of a letter. If we kept doing that to your book, what would happen to your book? Would your book get better and better? A six-year-old will tell you, no, it'll get worse and worse. Pretty soon, I won't even be able to read it. A six-year-old understands this. You have to be highly educated to not get this. And that's what happens with a lot of these PhD scientists. They truly, seriously are brilliant. Bible says there's a big difference between intelligence and wisdom. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A lot of these scientists, they don't fear the Lord. They don't even believe in God. So they got a lot of facts in their head, but they can't apply them properly because they lack wisdom. You'll see that in the next presentation. This is so straightforward. You don't make something better by randomly changing it. So the challenge for evolution, though, gets much worse than everything I've presented so far. And if you've been bored out of your skull, business picks up here. This is the fun portion of this particular talk. This is going to blow you away. I have presented this many, many times. I have yet to have even one skeptic come up and address what you are about to see. They'll come to my table. Why is there all, you know, evil in the world today? What about all the contradictions in the Bible? What about carbon-14 dating? What about dinosaurs? What about whatever? And I say, those are great topics. Could you first address why I was here tonight with this presentation? They go off into everything else. So this is pretty powerful. There are no silver bullets. There's nothing I could possibly share with you. If you tell this to a skeptic, they're going to say, oh, I didn't know that. I guess I've been wrong my whole life. Let me go to church and worship Jesus with you. We're dealing with a spiritual issue. You're never going to throw facts at them and say, oh, I was wrong. You can share these things to get them thinking. Put a pebble in their shoe, which is they have to deal with now. It's kind of annoying. They have to stop and deal with it or go the rest of their life with this problem. So that's what you're going to see. The problem for evolution gets much worse. And it has to do with the way the information is written on our DNA. Keep in mind, evolution works by something coming out of nothing. You got this big bang. It came from somewhere. That's a whole other talk. And then particles, you got hydrogen and helium, a little bit of lithium, and particles are banging together over billions and billions of years. And now we're here. That's how evolution, there's no purpose. It's not trying to accomplish anything. There's no plan out there. Just things are interacting. So picture particles interacting and creating what you're about to see, the information structure. The reason evolution cannot work by making random mutational changes is because how that information is written on your DNA. So let's say you're looking at a segment of your DNA and you're reading it, and it spells, was it a rat I saw? Kind of an interesting phrase. In English, we read from left to right. You may have already noticed, you can also read that backwards. was it a rat I saw? It's called a palindrome. Kind of fun. Not all that meaningful, but kind of fun that you could read it forwards and backwards. This is what we discovered about our DNA. Much of it can not only be read forwards, it can also be read backwards. So how do you have particles banging together, creating an information system you can read forwards and backwards? But guess what? The challenge for evolution to do that is worse than that. That was the same message. Doesn't read it. Doesn't matter if you read it backwards. You're not getting additional information. It's the same piece of information. But that's not what we see in our DNA. It's more like this. You look at the word desserts. You flip that around, read it backwards, it spells stressed, which is what I get when I don't get desserts. So we need to improve this information system to make it better. So let's introduce one of our mutations, a deletion. Get rid of the T. It doesn't spell desserts anymore, but it also doesn't spell stressed. One random change messed up two messages because you can read it forwards and backwards. But guess what? We don't have little words in our DNA you can read forwards and backwards. We have up to entire chapters of complex instructions you could read forwards and backwards. Let me give you an analogy so you can understand what I'm talking about here. Let's say you all have a job working for a cell phone company, and it is your training to write the instruction manual they give to the manufacturing plant so they can make the phones. That's what you do. Your boss comes to you one day and says, I got a project for you. I need you to write the chapter in the manual that explains how the phone is going to download apps from the web. And you say, yeah, I can do that. He says, thanks. He's walking away, and then kind of like Columbo, which some of you remember, because I'll just one more thing. When you write that chapter, you have to write it in such a way, if we read your chapter backwards, it's going to explain how the phone's going to play music files. You start laughing. You go, that's a good one, boss. Your boss doesn't crack a smile. He goes, no, I'm serious. We only have so much room in the manual. Your chapter has to make sense both ways. That is humanly impossible. It cannot be done. You can't even program a computer to do that. I did programming for 12 years. It can't happen. But that's what we're seeing in our DNA. You read a segment of the DNA one direction, and it's a set of information to code to make certain proteins to carry out a certain function in your body. Now you read it backwards. It's a completely different set of instructions, coding to make completely different proteins that carry out a different function in your body. Two major points with this. Particles banging together over time could never construct a complex information system that you can read forwards and backwards. And secondly, even if you did have that, when you make random changes to it, you will not improve it. You will make it worse and worse over time, faster and faster, because you're messing up two messages every time you make a random change. But that's what we have in our DNA. But guess what? The challenge for evolution, it gets worse than that. We have overlapping information in our DNA. So look at this strange phrase here. I like chocolate later that evening. Why is it strange? Because it's two phrases that overlap. I like chocolate, which is true, and later that evening. So overlaps in the middle. They share those letters, L-A-T-E. Overlapping information. This is what we have in our DNA. Overlapping information. Let's introduce a wonderful random mutation to make this better. We'll take the E out and put a Z in instead. It doesn't spell I like chocolate, and it doesn't spell later that evening. One random change messed up two messages. We don't have information in our DNA that overlap a few letters. We have information that overlaps up to entire chapters of information that overlap each other. Imagine trying to write a chapter that overlaps itself. So you read from beginning to end. Now you go back and start a few sentences in, go from that point over, and you have a whole other set of information. Impossible. That's what we have in our DNA. But the challenge for evolution gets worse than that. We have spliced information. So same strange phrase. I like chocolate later that evening. Let's underline a few segments and bring them down below. It spells I like her hat. That is a spliced message. Introduce a wonderful random mutation. Just delete the H. It doesn't spell I like chocolate. But now it doesn't spell I like her hat. The spliced information got messed up too. This is what we have in our DNA. But we don't have just a few letters that are spliced from here and there, put together for more information. We have long sentences and short paragraphs that are spliced. So you read a biochemistry textbook, You just learned a lot of information. Now go back and take random long sentences and short paragraphs from throughout the book, put them together. Oh, you got another chapter now. It's impossible to do that, humanly speaking, but that's what we have in our DNA. But the challenge gets worse than that. We have embedded messages in our DNA. Take a look at the sentence. Can you show Mike Owen checks from Oliver's latest facts and set it on the desk? Let's circle every ninth letter here and bring them down below. And it spells chocolate. There's a theme going on here. It's my talk. I can do that. This is an embedded message, and this is what we have in our DNA. Let's introduce a random mutation. We'll just delete the H. Now, that messes up the main sentence there, and it would shift all the letters after that deletion. It would shift them over one spot. So now when you circle every ninth letter, bring those down below, it's meaningless. So one random mutation messed up the main message, but it messed up the embedded message as well. We have embedded messages in our DNA. You get all of the regular information. You can circle every, like, so many spots on the DNA, put those together, you got another set of information. It is so complex. But the challenge gets worse than that. We have encrypted messages in our DNA. I actually had three interviews with the CIA to work in their cryptographic analysis division. Really creepy story for some other time. But encrypted messages. So let's take a look at this encrypted message here. You read it, it's like, it's illegible. It doesn't mean anything. What if there is an encryption key? Meaning everywhere there's an H up there, it's an A. Everywhere there's a B, it's really a C. Everywhere there's a Y, it's really a T. So those two Ys are really Ts. If you make all the substitutions up there, you see it spells this as an encrypted message. That's one way of doing data encryption. It can be very complex. But this is what we have in our DNA. So let's take a second to think through. What would be required in nature to create an encrypted message system? Keeping in mind, there's no God, no creator, no designer. You just have particles banging together. What would these particles have to do on their own without any intention? First of all, they would have to create and develop a language system using symbols. So when you have three sticks like that, if we put them together this way, we're going to call that an A. If you take those three shapes and put them together this way, we're going to call that a B. You have to create an entire alphabet through particles just banging into each other. Secondly, you have to create and define words. When you put these four letters together, it's going to represent that object. You have to create an entire dictionary of words and definitions by particles just kind of banging into each other. Then you have to write meaningful sentences and paragraphs, which requires rules of grammar. How do particles banging together create rules of grammar? It makes no sense. Then you have to establish the encryption system with that key that I mentioned. After that, you have to create the system that does the coding and the decoding. And then finally, you have to create the ability to read and carry out these instructions, or the whole thing is useless. There's not a scientist on this planet who could even begin to explain how particles banging together did any of this, but it's in the DNA. And lastly, I'm skipping some things, you can thank for that later. The challenge gets worse than that. We have 3D information in our DNA. This is harder to depict with PowerPoint. I'll do my best. When our DNA makes proteins that carry out most of the functions in our body, they're not these little mini ladders or anything. They're very, very three-dimensional folds of these proteins. If they don't get folded just right, they're useless and they get disassembled and the components are reused. It's like a lock and a key. It's very complex. I wish I had time to tell you how that works. I put 7 random words up here on the screen. We're going to fold these words, and all I can do here in PowerPoint is stack them on top of each other as we fold them. When we do that, you'll notice going up and down now, there's an additional piece of information, the word success. So you fold the other words right, you have an additional piece of information going up and down, kind of in a 3D fashion. Obviously, if we delete letters and change them, it would mess that up. But also, if we don't fold it this way, we fold it this way instead, you lose that piece of information. So what happens in these strings that get constructed, you have all the other levels of information, but you got something here and something here. When you fold it on top of the other one, you can read it up and down. You have additional information now that it's on top of the other one. It is unbelievably complex. So wrapping up this talk, we initially talked about certain things looking pretty good from a certain distance or a certain angle, like the bright red BMW. We envisioned opening that hood, seeing the beautiful engine. We just popped the hood on evolution. There's no engine there. There's nothing to drive evolution, to give you the new information that you need to turn a single cell into anything else. But that's what they teach. But they don't have the ability to create an astronomical amount of new information that's required to go from a single cell through every other life form and human beings. Here's a quote from a geneticist as we wind down. Genetics has no proofs for evolution. It has trouble explaining it. The closer one looks at the evidence, the less one finds substance. In fact, the theory keeps on postulating evidence and failing to find it moves on to other postulates. Fossil missing links, natural selection of improved forms, positive mutations, etc. This is not science. And one other quote you may have heard before: in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's what the Bible says. It's the very first verse, very foundational. The more we look at science, the more that makes sense. And we need to be very patient with the secular scientists and wait for them to catch up. I have an entire another presentation called Surprise. The Bible explains that. So many things they're discovering that is confusing to them. It doesn't make sense, but when you know the Bible, so you say surprise, that's what we would expect. Exactly what we would expect. So a lot of other examples. So anyway, lots of evidence that God is the creator.